Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Mercy Larson. Mercy, I believe you're from the Ohio area, am I correct?
Well, oh, you don't say that, because I'm from Michigan, and you know, Michiganders and Ohioans, you know, don't exactly, that's not the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry things are happening, so they don't always get along, but there was an actual war between Michigan and Ohio. That's a little known fact from history.
Well, hopefully the fact that I put you in the wrong geographic location isn't a deal breaker for the rest of the podcast.
So. No, I don't actually have those strong feelings because I'm from Iowa originally, but I've been living in Michigan with my husband since I started working as a physician here, so about 21 years ago. So I'm a transplant.
Ah, okay. But still you're a Michiganite.
I'm a Midwesterner for sure. Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So anyway, Mercy, for our listeners who may not know who you are, tell us who you are and also a little bit about yourself and also about the experience that has really shaped your current life path and your passions today.
Yeah, it's so hard to know where to start some of these stories, right? So, I think if you want to go back to what shaped me as me, it actually goes back a really long way. So I grew up, as I said, in Iowa, in just small town Iowa. And when I was in high school, both my mom and dad were diagnosed with cancer. And so that did shape me quite a bit. My mom was diagnosed with cancer first. She went through a whole year of treatment for her breast cancer. She seemed to be doing well. And then almost a year later, well, 14 months later, my dad was suddenly diagnosed with cancer. He had colon cancer. It was very aggressive. I learned later that they didn't really expect that he would survive, and he did. He got through all his treatment, and he did well, and I finished the rest of my high school years. And then about 2 days before I was going to graduate from high school, we found out that my mom's cancer had recurred and that she had metastasis to her bones and her liver. And that's kind of how then I started. I went off to college, and a lot of the people locally thought maybe I wouldn't go off to college. I would stay just close by to be near my mom, but she was very insistent. She wanted me to go off to college. So I did. But I think that changed my trajectory because I started thinking medically a little bit more than I would have otherwise, right? I'm from a farm town. I had cornfields all around me. I never went to the doctor more than once a year. And then suddenly I was in this very medical experience because for the next 2.5 years, my mom went through extensive treatment after treatment after treatment and subsequently died halfway through my junior year of college. And that was about the time that you're deciding what to do with your life. And I decided I wanted to be a doctor. And I remember going through one medical school interview and them saying that I was trying to be like a Pollyanna. And it wasn't really that I was trying to be a Pollyanna. It was that's suddenly what I was really exposed to. And so I went off to medical school. Even going through the story of my mom's death, it impacted me a lot because she was going through all these treatments, as I say, and unbeknownst to us, all of the chemo was slowly killing her heart. And so it was Christmas break in my junior year. I was home. She was feeling really bad. She had to go in. She was supposed to go in for chemo. And she just wasn't moving. And I was upset with her because she wasn't moving quick enough. And I get her in and we're late to the appointment. And I didn't want to be late to the appointment because I was trying to impress these people, right? And I'd worked with these people. They'd had let me shadow them and things. And I get there and her blood pressure was so low that she was almost like unconscious. So it was like a miracle she even had made it. They said, we're going to have to admit her to the hospital. We put her in the hospital. My parents had decided they're going to sell their house. We're going to have try to downsize so she can just live in an apartment. My brother and dad, it's Christmas Eve. My brother and dad are trying to move all of the stuff to the apartment. So she, when she goes home, she doesn't have to take these steps. And two nurses come in to the hospital room. They said, we need to talk to you for a minute. So granted, now I'm 21 years old. They pull me out of the room in the hallway and they said to me, we don't think you should be here by yourself because your mother could die at any moment. We didn't know this. We had no idea. They had said to us the day before, your mother, or Marlene to her, you would be a great candidate for a heart transplant if you didn't have cancer. Okay, those are the words they said. They did not say, so you are going to die, but that's what they thought they said. They thought that they told us that this was terminal and she was going to die, but they didn't. They just said, you'd be a great candidate for a heart transplant, but since you have cancer, you can't get one. And I had to turn around and go back into that room. And my mother looked at me and she said, I'm dying, aren't I? And I had to say, yes, Mom, you are. And I thought at that moment, like, wow, they screwed up so bad, because they did, right? Mm-hmm. No 21-year-old girl should have to tell their mother that they're that she's dying. This should be their job. And it wasn't their job, and I had to do it. But I was determined that that's not the kind of doctor I would be, and that I would be better, and that I would never let anything like that happen. And then I went on to medical school, and I went on to residency, and no one ever taught me about death. And I really didn't do any better. I really didn't. I had periods of time. I had kids that died and that I took care of. I didn't do better, but I didn't realize it. Until years later, now I'm married. My husband is an anesthesiologist. We're now living in Michigan. I've got three kids, good life, everything going well. I'm thinking to myself, I've kind of done my bad stuff, right? I had all that bad stuff as a kid. And then we're on our way to a baseball game. Our car gets rear-ended and my 14-year-old son is killed. And it changed everything again. And then that's when I slowly started to realize that I hadn't done everything better. I still didn't know anything about death. I still didn't know how to help patients. I still didn't do any of that. And my life was just crushed because I had been under this kind of false impression that I had done my bad thing and that things were going to be good now for me and that I was going to lead this good life and that there's no way God would let something really bad happened to me again. But that's not how life works at all. And you can have bad things happen again and again even when you feel like you're doing the right thing. So that's why I say it was like a long story, because obviously the story you knew about, and the only story you knew about, was the story of Andy dying. But really, it goes back much, much further than that for me.
Yeah. And the thing that struck me is at 21 years old, the way you were given the news about your mom, it was like, well, you might as well just had somebody drop a ton of bricks on you. But yeah. There was just no warning, no preparation.
It's so funny because they thought they did, right? And I knew that. I realized that after becoming a physician, that they thought they had told me, because no one teaches doctors and nurses really how to be with someone when they're dying and how to talk about death. You talk about healing. You talk about getting better. You talk about the next treatment. And that's all that it was the whole way through with my mom. We tried treatment after treatment after treatment. And there was only one treatment that was attacking the cancer successfully. And that was the one that was killing her heart. So, you know, they'd say, oh, she's had too much of this. We're going to switch to something else. Well, then the cancer would come back. And so they'd switch back to the other thing. And then the cancer would go down. But of course, her heart was getting affected. We just didn't know that that's what was really ultimately happening. And I remember, too, when I had to tell my mom, when she said, I'm dying, aren't I? And I said, yes, Mom, you are. And she rubbed my head. She pulled me up close and held me and rubbed my head. That I remember to this day about how she comforted me when I had to tell her that she was dying. you know, and then I ended up having to leave the room and go down to find a payphone, because of course this is way before the days of cell phones. Mm-hmm. Find a payphone to call my dad and say, "Hey, you need to come back because they say she could die any day." And it turns out we went to hospice the next day, and she actually died 3 days later. So she didn't die on Christmas Eve; she died on the 28th of December. But still, not a way to handle it, not a way to find out.
No, and for me, and you know my story, obviously, with Janine, because I have to let the audience know I was a guest on your marvelous podcast, Always Andy's Mom, and we talked. The way the news was given to me, it was a 5-minute consult. You know, the message I got through, unless there's a miracle, your daughter's going to die. And you know, in retrospect, I look back, and I know doctors take death very personal, even though they know it's part of the deal when they become, you know, they become doctors. But, you know, I'm thinking, well, there could have been a better way for her to present that news to me. But then I also tried to look at it from her perspective. Maybe she had lost another patient earlier in that day. Maybe there was something else that was stressing her out. But in reality, at least I knew what I was looking at. And it was a mere 10 months after we got the diagnosis that my daughter Janine died.
But yeah, it's a delicate balance, right?
It is.
Because
it really
I think
is.
You really do have to try to be honest about it, because obviously people were not direct enough with us to let us know that death was imminent, that she was dying, and someone should have done that. But on the other hand, just bluntly throwing it out there and then not leaving any time for processing, any time for discussion, any time for anything is also bad. But it's why I think my husband and I have kind of taken it upon ourselves to do some education in the medical community about doing things the right way, because I think you are 100% right. It can be done wrong on both ends of the spectrum. And I think we are good examples of one taking, just avoiding the topic altogether, assuming it would be inferred, and the other one just putting it out there in a sentence or two and just letting it sit.
And I would assume the emphasis on education transformed your work as a pediatrician, in part because you put the focus on education with your clients now?
Yeah, absolutely. It just changed me. It just changed so much of me and what I think about. You know, it's funny because right away after Andy died, I tried to go back to work and it was a failure. I just couldn't. I just kept seeing all these whole families and healthy kids, and I couldn't talk to moms about, you know, my 4-year-old keeps waking up in the middle of the night and coming into my room, because all I would think about was, oh my gosh, I just wish Andy would come in my room in the middle of the night. I couldn't do any of those things. And then I honestly had like a revelation later that I started thinking about how worried people must be, right? So and then that changed my job to trying to help alleviate worry. So when I would have somebody come in initially after Andy died and their kid had a fever for an hour, I would be thinking, what are you doing here? Your kid's had a fever for an hour. They're fine. Just wait. It's going to get better. But then I started thinking, okay, why are they here when their child has had a fever for an hour? They're really worried.
Yes.
They're really worried. Like they think maybe their boss had a nephew who had cancer and the first sign was fever, or they're super worried that this sickness is going to go on and they're going to miss work and they're going to lose their job because they've missed too much work because of this. And if they can take them in right away, maybe I can change something. There's a lot going into that. And once I was able to kind of think about it in a more compassionate way about what's your biggest worry, it helped and it changed my practice forever.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the challenges that we experience as a result of the death of a child, the death of someone close to us, it does change the landscape, one of who we are and how we do things.
Yeah. I mean, you don't like to admit this, or I certainly didn't like to admit this early on, because I didn't want anything good to come from Andy's death. Mm-hmm. Right? Andy's death was just bad. Everything about it was bad. I felt like I should just feel bad about it. I should be sad. I should be angry. I should be all those negative things. But I certainly didn't want there to be good from it. But ultimately, over time, because now it's been 7 years, I realize that there can be a lot of good from things too. And that, you know, I'm a more compassionate person now. I'm a more compassionate doctor now. I have a podcast. I started a podcast about a year after Andy died. So, you know, it was several months after Andy died. I'm home now. I'm not working. I feel like I'm never going to work again. I saw an amazing therapist, by the way, who, you know, one of the first things she said to me was, if you want to, we will get you back. And that was, no, that happened. But what happened, I was maybe 5 or 6 months in, and I thought, I'm going to try to listen to a podcast on child loss. Because my husband did a podcast. He's like, I had a medical podcast. And I thought, there's certainly got to be a podcast, because I couldn't read, because I was trying to read and couldn't concentrate enough to read. And it was really, really difficult. So I thought maybe a podcast, I could listen to that when I'm at home. And I looked and I couldn't find one. I mean, this was 2018 and I could not find I could find grief podcasts. I couldn't find one specific to child loss at that time. And my husband came home and I said, I was looking for a podcast today on child loss and I can't find one. And he said, oh, there has to be one. There's a podcast on everything. I will look for you. And so he starts looking and he goes, you're right. There isn't one. And I still feel like this is some sort of divine intervention that I said out loud, I think I'm supposed to start one. Where that came from, I don't know. And as soon as the words came out of my mouth, I immediately wanted to pull them back because I knew that when my husband heard that, he would be like, okay, because he was concerned about me. I'm not able to do a lot. And if I could get a little bit of purpose and meaning and do this podcast, he was all over it, right? He knew how to do a podcast. He could help me start the podcast. So he started, you know, just encouraging me and encouraging me. And I'm trying to back off and I don't think so. I'm not sure. I don't know why I said that. I'm not very technically savvy. But by May, he found someone to make me a website for free and he found all these different things. And so we hit the summer about at the year anniversary and he said, let's just record one. Let's just see. And in the meantime, I had gone on his, like I said, his is a medical podcast, but we did one, his 25th episode, actually. And we talked about it. We talked about what had happened because, of course, he had stopped podcasting for several weeks at least. And we did one. And so he said, let's record one. Let's just see what happens. Yeah. And so here it was August. We're in our basement. I recorded this episode. We go through the whole thing. We finish. It hits an hour. I look at the recording. I never press record. And I said, okay, yep, I'm not meant to do this. I didn't press record. You know, let's just forget it. And he said, nope, we're going to do it again. And so I press record this time and we did it again. And the second one was better. The second version that we went through was considerably better than the first. Then I did a couple more. I recorded two more and then I just put it out there, put it out. And this is like September of 2019. We did a little media push thing. So I was on the local news and things like that. And within a few days, I had my first podcast review or the Apple podcast. And she said, I couldn't get out of bed until I listened to you. My son died a week ago by suicide. Yep. And I was like, okay, I help one person. And if that's all I ever do is help one person, I think maybe we should keep going. And I interviewed a woman. I don't know if you've ever read the book Rare Bird. It's a phenomenal book. Anna Winston Donaldson, her name. Have you read it?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's the only one that I could really read very early in my grief. And she was coming to speak at an event that I was signed up for. And I said, pulled her aside and I said, I'm thinking about starting this podcast. And she said, I've always wanted to start a podcast. You need to start this podcast. You need to do the podcast. So she was one of my very early guests, too. And she promoted it a little bit and had a big social media presence. So I think that kind of helped. And it just sort of took off. And I realized that I was trying to help other people get a little bit of hope and healing. Yep. And make them feel like they weren't alone. And it ended up helping me more than I ever imagined it would. I did not do it at all thinking it would help me. I really didn't. I did it because I had been feeling alone. I was starting to not feel as alone. And I just wanted to give people some hope. And it turns out we started recording episodes in August. I started releasing in September. I went back to work by November. And by January, I was working the same schedule that I had been working before Andy died. So that brought that much healing to me just by sharing stories and being in this community with other people and making me not feel alone and having like a little purpose for my grief. It was like something I could do. And I spent all day Tuesday and all day Friday on it. I worked Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. Tuesdays and Fridays were like my podcast days, my Andy days, my grief days. I just felt like I poured all of that time into that, those days, so that the other days I actually could do something else. I mean, I could work as a doctor again, which I didn't know I'd be able to do.
Well, you know, one of the things you had mentioned is that never anything good that comes out of death, but it's the challenges that we experience as a result of death that help us find our purpose in the aftermath of traumatic loss. And I think that's a great point, because if somebody said to me early in my journey with Janine that, you know, you've really grown as a result of Janine's death, I would have looked at them and said, there's nothing good about death.
Yeah.
But as far as the growth with the challenges I've had to encounter and my family had to encounter, yes, there is growth as a result of those challenges, but not from the direct event itself. And I know with your podcast, you've done, I know I was the 312th episode, so you have had a robust run as a podcaster featuring stories from many different parents who have experienced the death of a child. And I could see where that would inspire you, because I think, one, we create our own sense of community when we reach out to help others, whether it's through podcasting, whether it's through a virtual support group or an in-person support group. But every story that I hear, Mercy, inspires me. It makes me better as a person of service, teaches me something. And it doesn't matter if that person is 5 months into their grief or 22 years into their grief. I still learn something from every story that I get. Even if it's just the importance of needing to learn how to survive and celebrating the need to survive before we can thrive.
Yeah, it's amazing. You are 100% right. I've had people on the podcast that are 4 months in, and I think, I don't know how you are doing a podcast right now, but you want to do a podcast, we'll do a podcast. And then I have others that are 25, 30 years after their loss. And I learned something from each of them.
Yep. Tell our audience about Andy. Tell us what made Andy, Andy. And I know, for those of you who are watching on YouTube, I don't know if you're in Andy's room right now.
I am in Andy's room.
Okay. So tell our audience about Andy.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because that's, you know, when I do an episode, that's how I start every single one. Every single one, I say that. And I was thinking to myself as we were talking, like, I didn't get to talk about Andy. So I'm so glad you did that, because it is, I mean, you saw me smile as soon as you asked me to talk about him. So he was our middle. He was our middle son. And he just was the glue. He really was. He was a super emotional kid. He had ADHD. He had anxiety as a kid. He was a struggle in many ways. But he really was the glue. He, you know, loved his siblings so much. He loved being the member of a team. He loved being in sports, but he wasn't very good at it because he was so short. All my kids are really tiny. So Andy was always the shortest one in his class, you know, but loved to be a cheerleader. So he would never start on the sports team that he was on. He always was pulled in off the bench, kind of one of the last kids, but he cheered for his teammates like you would not believe. Everybody wanted Andy on his team, on their team, because he just celebrated it all, you know? What's crazy is a week before Andy died, he was trying out for our high school soccer team. And we went to a charter school, so it was a much smaller school. And almost everybody was going to make the team. Not everybody, but almost everybody would make the team. And he made the team. But not only did he make the team, so they started practice 2 weeks before school started. And he was having the best practices of his entire life. He was so excited when he got in the car, and he shared with me, I'm just making every goal and I was doing all this. And they named him left striker because he was kicking with his left foot like he had never done. And I remember thinking to myself, oh God, at some point in time, this coach is going to realize Andy is not that good. And he's just going to be crushed because he was named starter on the team. You know, not only did he make the team, he's named starter. And he's just flying high. And this was the day before he died. And I realized that after that happened, I feel like that was a gift from God to give Andy those best practices ever. And that, I mean, he was so happy. He was so happy to be a part of that team. He was so happy to be going to his school. Like, he just was, his favorite phrase was, "I'm so excited," because he would just get so excited about everything. So, like, the day he died, he said, he called me up because they had orientation the first half of the day. And I was only working a half day, so I was going to be able to go pick him up. And he called me. And I said, "Okay, I'm almost done. I'll come and get you." And I said, "I'll be there in," I don't know what I said, 5 to 7 minutes or something. So 6 minutes later, he calls me. I'm on the road still. Like, "Andy, I told you I'd be there in 5 to 7 minutes. I'm not quite there yet." And he said, "Oh, Mom, I'm just so excited. I just couldn't wait." And I said, "Why are you excited? Are you excited about orientation today? Excited about your new friends? Excited about soccer practice tonight?" He goes, "No, I'm excited because we're going to a baseball game tonight," because just everything would excite him. I just missed that so much. I missed that excitement that he had. And then the other thing, he was a very, very talented singer. He sang for the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys. He was a senior head chorister. He just had the voice of an angel. And, you know, he's this tiny little kid and he hadn't gone through puberty. So his voice was still really high. He sang one of those high soprano parts and those concerts. I mean, he would have doubts about himself because, you know, he wasn't the best at sports and he wasn't the best in school with his ADHD and all of that. But, you know, you put him in front of a congregation singing and he would shine. I mean, he was so, so incredibly talented. So that was a beautiful thing. And his confidence just soared there. You know, it's funny because we talked to his choir director after he died. He spoke at his funeral. And, you know, we're talking about how he was always moving and fidgety and not always able to focus. And his choir director was like, I don't understand. This is not the Andy I know. The Andy I knew was attentive and focused and sang like an angel and had a face that would just show so much emotion and expression. It was beautiful. So it's beautiful to hear kind of different people describe him. So anyway, that's my Andy, who was just an amazing kid.
Yeah, it sounds like it, just from, you know, wearing his emotions on his sleeve to being passionate about what he loved, who he loved.
Yeah.
Sounds like he was
actually have made a scholarship called the Andy Larson Teammate Award. And it's not to be for the best kid on a team and the smartest kid on the team or anything like that. It's just to be, you know, for the best teammate. So yeah, if you just go show good sportsmanship and are a wonderful teammate, and those are the kids that we look for to give that scholarship to his school.
Well, and he certainly is a light to the world, and his legacy will continue to live on as long as you are going to make sure he's remembered and known. From what I know of you, Mercy, that he's not going to be forgotten anytime soon.
Well, and if you listen to the end of every single episode, the very end is Andy singing. It goes all the way, and it's him singing the solo to Away in the Manger in the December before he died. And the third verse of Away in the Manger, it ends with, "And fit us for heaven to live with thee there." So his last line is about living in heaven with Jesus. Yeah. And obviously, we would have had no idea that that would have happened only 8 months after singing that song. So
no, and who would have thought? I mean, as a parent, there isn't a handbook, there isn't a textbook that tells us how to deal with the death of a child. And certainly when I became a parent, if you told me, you know, when I was 25, that at 47, I'd be burying one of my children, I would have looked at you like you had two heads.
Yeah.
Because that was not even in my, that wasn't even in my radar. But, And for those who are going to be watching the YouTube version, There'll be a couple of pictures of Andy that we're gonna layer over the audio so that he is remembered and we can honor him by putting a name with the face.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. I wasn't gonna let you go without talking about Andy. That was definitely gonna be the be one of the topics of discussion. So,
well, good, good.
Well, our stories so, make us.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then also I do support groups now. We were talking mm-hmm. about the podcast that I do. I also do some facilitate some support groups, which have been really amazing to do that too. I feel like that brings even more of a sense of community because I think we have created a sense of community here just with the podcast. And I know that people listen and it's hard to sometimes put yourself out there and to go to a support group. An in-person support group or a virtual support group or anything, that takes a lot of courage and bravery. I remember going to my first support group and it was hard to set foot in that room. So I think the podcast does something to kind of help ease into things a little bit where you can become a part of a community without really having to be a part of that community. And then the next thing I've done is, now this is not through my podcast, this is through different organizations called Starlight Ministries that's based out of West Michigan, but we do now virtual support group for bereaved parents that I facilitate one on Tuesday mornings. And so if people want to be a part of that, you can go to starlightmin.org and find out more information on that. But I think that's like the next step, that now people come and they want to be a part of a smaller group and be able to talk to other bereaved parents and feel like they're in a sense of community. Yep. And then what has often happened is that then they're on that. And then pretty soon I get a text message or an email that says, you know, I think maybe it's time I want to come on the podcast and share the story now. So it's beautiful to be able to kind of walk through this with people, walk through this journey with people and see how people grow and change despite the most horrible circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I always say to, you mentioned this, I don't like to say that a lot of good, that all of this good came because Andy died. I always say all of this happened in spite of the fact that Andy died, because Andy's death was horrible. In spite of the horror of all of that, some good can come of it, but not because of it. And I think there's a distinction there.
Very definitely. And I think, you know, one of the things I've learned through my own journey of grief is to be mindful of my words. If I'm working with a parent whose son died in a car accident or sudden death, what are some things I want to avoid saying? How do I want to, you know, focus on the verbiage? I want to be mindful of those issues that are related to cause of death, so I'm not doing anything to undermine that. So it's always now that whenever I go into a situation, it's like, think first, what do I want to say? If that were me, what would I want said to me? What would I not want said to me? And, you know, one of the things that's happened, I've become, I think, a lot smarter as a result, in spite of what's happened to me. I've become smarter in terms of how I approach people now, because I wouldn't want to say anything that would be construed as insensitive or undermining somebody's grief. So now I'm mindful about, how do I do this? How do I go into a situation? What do I say? How do I act? How do I create a presence that's going to be welcoming and that's going to be supportive?
Yeah.
So.
And so many people, they try to say the right thing and then it ends up not being. And so I think giving people grace is so important.
Yes.
Because they're not meaning to say things that are insensitive, but oftentimes that is what happens too.
Well, that's the importance of education. I've been seeing more and more books written by individuals who are trying to help those who are supporting grief say and do the right thing. So there are now books for that have suggestions. So, you know, I think individuals who are in the grief world are realizing that community just isn't with those individuals who have experienced a loss. It's those people who are supporting them. And how can they best support people who are grieving? That creates a welcoming, a very inclusive, and a very tolerant community in terms of where we could witness all measures of grief, all ways that individuals grieve, and hold space for that. So what else, and I know besides the podcast has been extremely helpful to you in your grief, the education that you do with your patients, what else has helped you get to right now the 7+ year point in the aftermath of Andy's death? What else has been helpful for you?
Well, you know, I'm going to go back and tell you another story. Okay. And this is a story about Andy from when he was seven years old. I went to pick him up from school. He, of course, in his excitedness that Andy always had, was very excited because he had drawn a family picture. And it had been on one of those big rolled up sheets of paper, right? So he had it all rolled up. He's sitting in his booster still in the back seat of the van. And he's telling me about this picture. And he's so excited to show me this picture of the family. And we get home and I open up the door to the van and he unrolls this picture as he's still sitting there because he's so excited to show me. And I look at the picture and there are four people in the picture. And I'm thinking to myself, who did he leave out of the picture? Like, we are a family of five. There are four people in the picture. Did he leave out his brother or sister? Who did he leave out? I said, Andy, what are the four people in the picture? And he said, I said, who's not in the picture? And he said, oh, mommy, I'm not in the picture. I'm not going to grow up all the way. I'm going to be in heaven.
Wow.
What's so crazy is that in my heart of hearts, at that moment, I knew it was true. Like, I knew that that was true and that was going to happen. And I was so upset about it, right? I was really upset about it. He was so proud of this picture. And from the moment I could, when he forgot about the picture, I threw it in the trash. I mean, I got rid of the picture. But I told people about it because it affected me so much. And I had this overwhelming sense that that was true. And he was fine with it. I mean, he was totally fine with it. I'm not going to grow up all the way. I'm going to be in heaven. And that's exactly what happened, right? He grew up part of the way. He was 14 years old. He was just starting to go through puberty, but he didn't grow up the whole way. And on the night he died, we're in the hospital. Peter had a concussion. So he had to be hospitalized. So we're in the room and Peter's now sleeping and Eric and I are just crying. And Eric turned to me and he said, remember the picture? Which of course I had. Of course I had remembered that picture. And as much as I hated that picture, it brought me a little bit of a sense of peace in a way because I knew Andy was okay with it. He's totally fine with it. And I think had I asked him later, even a few weeks later about the picture, I don't think he would have remembered. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think really it was more a gift to me that and to other people. And I told Eric, I told friends, I told a lot of people because I told that story at his funeral. Yeah. And people remembered the picture because it was such a profound thing for a little boy to say that my friends remembered and they knew how negatively it had affected me at the time. But I do think that having that experience, as painful as it was at the time, has been helpful to me and that I can always turn to that and be like, but he's okay with it.
Yes.
He's okay with it. He's not upset and he's not sad. And, you know, also just a few weeks before he died, we were in a carpool with the people that were with other people from the choir. And one of the other moms, we had been studying in Bible study, the book of Revelation, which is all about going to heaven. And his little friend, Charlie, somehow they started talking about death. And Charlie's like, I don't want to talk about death. I'm scared about that or something like that. And Andy said, what are you talking about, Charlie? I'm so excited to go to heaven. Heaven is going to be so awesome. And his mom was thinking, my word, I can't believe this 14-year-old kid is talking about how he's excited to go to heaven. This is just kind of an, you know, weird thing. But again, then a few months later, he dies and he's in heaven. And it gave me a little comfort, too, when she told me that about how it affected her and how he really was okay with dying. Yeah. So I think that has helped me. You know, it has helped me to be able to have that knowledge. And really, it was a gift. I mean, it was a gift from God for me. Just so I'm not as worried maybe about like where he is and if he's okay and any of that. Because for me, it's like, that's all okay. I miss him terribly. And when people say stupid things like he's better off where he is, I like, no, he's better off with me. No. I'm still upset by those comments. I still don't like people saying them. But if I say things to myself, knowing that he's okay, then it's fine, right? Yeah. I don't want other people to say it to me, but it does help, not in always the day-to-day little stuff, but in the bigger picture, it has given me a little more hope, I think.
Yeah, and I've read accounts of other children whose parents have talked about their children having premonitions that their life on Earth wasn't going to be an extended period of time. But the fact, you know, it sounds like he knew where he was going. He knew that he was going to be with God. He knew that.
Yeah.
And though it was going to be painful for him to leave his family, he knew he was going to be okay. And he knew he was going to be taken care of, you know, on the other side. He knew where he was going, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. You're right. I mean, if somebody said to me, well, your daughter's in a better place. You know, your daughter's in a better place. Well, no, her better place is still with me after 22 years.
Right, you know? Exactly.
You know, I can think that because I know that she's with God. I believe in that. I believe that that's where she is. But it's like, you know, a brother can kind of harass their brother. But if somebody else harasses their brother, their brother's going to go after him. So
Exactly. But, I could say those things to myself. Other people just can't say them to me.
The other thing too, it's interesting because I found out after the fact, and my wife Sherry told me this, that about 2 years before Janine was diagnosed with cancer, they were on the deck outside in our house, and Janine had asked her mother, "Mom, what's it like to have cancer?" This was 2 years before she got diagnosed. So as we've looked back in retrospect and with other events, we sense that she knew that her time on Earth was going to be short. Uh-huh. But we didn't know that until after the fact. But as I've come to understand, there's a lot of children have premonitions or have kind of a sense, their soul has a sense that, you know, I'm only here for a short period of time. I take the cushion out of their physical absence and it doesn't reduce the yearning anymore, but it gives us maybe some greater understanding in the midst of our own grieving. So, but thank you for sharing that. We are almost out of time, and I could talk to you probably for about another hour or so. But I know you have some things you got a 9:30 group coming up. So
I do.
So, if you could leave our listeners with one takeaway, just one ultimate takeaway from today, and you've already left us with a lot, Mercy, what would that be?
I really think the idea of grace and not only giving other people grace, but giving yourself grace. I mean, this is hard. This is hard work. You can't do it on your own. I mean, you can, but it's better not to. It's better to really grieve in community. Don't be so hard on yourself.
Yes.
It's just, you've not had to do anything like this before. And even if you have, okay, let's just go back. I grieved my mom when I was in college. I thought I kind of knew grief, honestly. Andy died. And I thought to myself, I remember thinking, well, you have done this before. Eric's never done this. This is my husband, Eric. You're going to really have to be there for him and show him what this is like, what grief is like. And I didn't have a clue. Grieving my mom as a college student and grieving your son as a 40-year-old woman, not the same at all. So, you know, just give yourself grace and know that every circumstance is different and you don't have certain expectations on things that you need to do or milestones that you need to meet. Or once it's been this long, I need to be better. I need to have done this. Just be patient with yourself.
Yes. And give yourself that grace to do your journey and take as long as it takes for you to get from the raw pain of grief to a point where you want to reengage in life again. And there's no specific time frame for that. You're absolutely right. So if people want to get in touch with you again, subscribe or follow your podcast, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you know, my website is andysmom.com. You can email me at Marcy, M-A-R-C-Y, at andysmom.com. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. That's at Always Andy's Mom. So those are good ways to follow me as well. The name of my podcast is actually called Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom, because my husband said, you can't just say Always Andy's Mom because people aren't going to know what it's about. That's what it's called. The official title is Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom.
And I'll make sure all of your contact information gets in the episode notes when our episode goes live. And with that, Mercy, thank you so much for just a great conversation today. I enjoyed spending time with you, and hopefully we can do this again in the future.
I know. Thank you so, so much.
You're welcome. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.